It's one of those places you hear rumors about, the lost city of the UW Arboretum in Madison. You might wonder, what's there and how did it get lost?
Today in our Curious Wisconsin installment, we'll find out. Kathy Miner joins us. She's an Arboretum naturalist and guide. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the lost city?
Well, the Lost City, its official name was Lake Forest, and it was going to be a grand and elegant suburb running basically between Lake Wingra and Fish Hatchery Road. It covers quite a bit of land, which is now the Arboretum.
And how extensive is it?
840 acres is the number we're given, which is, if you think about it, about two-thirds of the present Arboretum, because our size is 1260 or so. So about a little over 1 square mile, maybe 1.3 square miles.
So why was this never finished?
Well, there were a variety of reasons, some having to do with the land and some having to do with people and some having to do with politics. And the part that had to do with the land was that they were building on swampland. And though they did some homework, the developers, about how much fill they would need and what they would need to remediate, they miscalculated or underestimated. And so they didn't use enough fill, and roads literally sank, became covered with water. But the another big piece of it was that the bond company that was underwriting the Lake Forest Land Company, the operator of that bond company, was involved in fraud. He'd been in real estate fraud in Chicago before he came to Madison, unbeknownst to the Lake Forest developers. And when he left Madison, he engaged in some fraud out on the East Coast. So the bond company went under. The money had been used for other things. And so that was a big problem. And then the third piece of it was that because the land, the Lake Forest Land Company, operated between 1911 and 1922, World War I came along and drastically affected the national economy.
Now, you've actually been to this lost city. What does it look like if you stumble on it today?
Well, it's interesting. It would be possible to walk back there and not really know. Nature is taking the concrete paving back little by little. There are places where you can see concrete edges and you know you must be walking on an old road. But there are other places where they're really, really well hidden and you'd have to scrape away quite a bit of dirt or leaf duff before you would see any evidence.
And can you see it? Have people done flyovers and gotten aerial shots? Does it kind of stand out when you look at it from above?
It doesn't stand out. Wouldn't stand out anymore. There are aerial photographs done. We have one from 1937, and I believe there was one in the early 1950s. And, of course, now we have satellite photographs. But at this point, the forest is dense enough, and the undergrowth in particular is dense enough that you might never know. But there are a couple of crumbling foundations in the middle of the woods. And if you know where to find them, you can see concrete, moss-covered concrete front steps and remains of foundations.
Now, why wouldn't the Arboretum have removed that stuff? They know it's there. It's not what nature intended. Why is it still there?
Well, there were a half a dozen houses built between the present-day Martin and Carver streets on the side streets that go between them, and those are still standing and surrounded by much newer homes, and so, of course, that is still a residential area. But I think it was probably a matter of expense, of just simply not having the money or the labor available to tear up the old pavement and do the kind of remediation that would have been needed.
So when you're taking people on a tour of the Arboretum, along with the nature, is the Lost City part of the tour?
Once a year, we do a tour of the Lost City. It's always on the Sunday closest to Halloween. We make that association between the mysterious Lost City and possibly hauntings. And so it is on the last Sunday in October. And we start with a slideshow indoors with some photographs and some history of the thing, and then we go out and hike to it, and we find the pavement edges as we come across them. And then just that once, we do take people off our regulation trails, and we bushwhack around through the woods to find one in particular of the crumbling foundations. I have to say here that we really don't want to encourage people to be wandering around back there for their own safety and for the sake of the wildlife and the ecosystem that's back there. But once a year, we do sanction it, and it's really quite interesting. Lots of people show up. It's a very intriguing topic.
Now, you mentioned hauntings. Are there actual reports of hauntings at the Lost City?
I've actually heard of stories of hauntings and mysterious noises in some of the other wooded areas of the Arboretum. I'm not aware of any in there, but I will tell you that I was, before I started doing the tours of the Lost City area, I was back there once by myself doing some scouting, and it happened to be approaching sunset, and I was standing at this crumbling foundation and front steps, and a great horned owl began to hoot from quite nearby. And I didn't stick around a whole lot longer after that.
not a literal haunting, but a haunting sound.
Exactly,
anyway.
Yes.
So when I think of a name like Lost City, I want to picture an amateur Indiana Jones exploring around there. Do archaeologists or do local historians go in and try to find relics of the Lost City?
There is some interest, and actually we recently rediscovered another one of the foundations, and there are a few areas where there are kind of dirt piles where there might possibly be some things. And we were just recently in contact with the State Historical Society to see if they wanted to come and take another look or see if there were things of archaeological significance, because at this point there's quite a bit of much more modern day artifacts like beer cans or something like that around, mixed in with the material that might legitimately be from the early 20th century.
So it sounds like something that, it's news to me. Has it been sort of a well-kept secret over the years?
Well, as I said, again, we don't really want to encourage exploring off the regulation trails, but on the regular sanctioned trails of the Arboretum, it is quite possible to see pavement edges and to see evidence that you're in something that was once going to be a residential development. But it's not, you could also really walk around there for quite a while and not have any idea.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming it's not okay if I want to take the kids and go try to find things and pick them up there, unless it's the beer cans. We're
right.
Welcome to those, I bet.
Right. It's okay, certainly, to be hiking on the regular trails in daylight hours. But any material that you find, I mean, I guess if it's clearly 21st century trash, that you'd be doing us a favor if you picked up the litter. But if you saw anything that looked like an old piece of pottery or an old bottle of any kind or something, really, you shouldn't be collecting any sort of material in the Arboretum, plant or animal material or anything, without a research permit, because we're a research area and institution. And so if you saw something like that, what we'd appreciate is that you make a note of the location the best you can and notify someone at the Arboretum so we can investigate it.
Surprised you would suggest that, Rob. Very disappointed.
All right. I'll hang my head in shame.
Oh, it's so understandable. We know how intrigued everyone is.
Well, I want to ask you, if this thing had gone forward and there was this giant, you said it was intended to be very grand city in the Arboretum, would there be an Arboretum today? What would it be like?
Well, there certainly wouldn't be one of anything like the size it is. They planned more than 1,000 lots in this 840 acres. The lot sizes were small by today's standards. They would have been maybe 40 feet by 100 or so feet in size. But they planned in many elegant details. There were central circles with civic and public buildings in them, and every homeowner was to have water access in one way or another through a system of canals, so that if you had a boat, you could get down to the water. There was a 9-hole golf course across Fitch Hatchery Road. They planned in many amenities, and it was supposed to be a really lovely place to live, at least according to the propaganda put out by the developers. But as we've discussed, a number of reasons, it didn't work out.
And I'm guessing, as an Arboretum guide, you're pretty happy with the way things did ultimately work out.
I won't pretend that I'm sorry that we now have a natural refuge and a green island in the middle of the city instead of more city. But I do understand some of the work that went into the project, and I find it a fascinating history.
Now, are you aware of other lost cities like these existing elsewhere in the country?
Not really. I'm sure there must be. It's like when you go out west looking for a ghost town or something, looking for places where plans were made that didn't quite work out.
All right, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today and introducing us to the Lost City.
Thanks for the invitation. It was great.
That's Kathy Miner. She's a naturalist and guide at the UW Arboretum in Madison. She also helps Stephanie Elkins produce Simply Folk here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I think we might have to have her back next Halloween to hear about maybe ghost stories in the Arboretum. I get the feeling we just sort of scratched the tip of the iceberg there.
And do watch the Arboretum tour schedule for when that tour comes up in 2014.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Well, if there's something you are curious about in Wisconsin, let us know and we can try to get you some information on it. You can call the Central Time hotline. That number is 855-683-5422, 855-683-5422.
Or you can email us, centraltime@wpr.org.
Still to come today on Central Time, our guest explores the rise of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a unique perspective on immigration reform in the United States. Our guest says states should compete to bring in the most immigrants to boost their economies.
First, Rupert Murdoch's media empire spans the globe, including Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, The Times of London, and much, much more. Our next guest traces the rise of that empire and recent scandals that threaten it. David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks guys so much for having me.
Let's jump to the beginning of Rupert Murdoch's media career. What did he learn as an Australian newspaper publisher that led to his incredible international success?
Well, I think he learned a sense of, being willfully blind to the restraints that were imposed on him. I mean, here's a guy who basically time and again found ways to push up against the regulations on what he was allowed to invest in, on what he felt were the unfair public subsidies of public broadcasting in Australia, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which ended up being a powerful player, not just in radio, but television, and who in... took lessons about that to places like Britain, where it was seen that an Australian-born guy who was a tabloid news editor, he took over the News of the World and the Sun there and turned them from struggling titles into the nation's most popular newspapers, that a guy like that shouldn't be allowed to own two of the nation's most prestigious papers. And he sort of pushed against what people saw as limitations on how many papers one person should own, and he just sort of steamrolled it through. And time and again, he's done the same thing with television holdings, both in the UK and the US. So I guess what he took there was sort of a healthy disdain for the idea that simply because people had limitations in place that he should accept the world as it's been designed and instead tried to conform others the way he thought things should be situated.
And it's not just regulations. In a lot of ways, the customs of media, he thought no longer applied, right?
Well, here's a guy who introduced to the British tabloids, which were already, you know, papers that often like to focus on crime and scandal, but he really upped the ante, making it a much crueler, I think, a much more tougher, at times more punitive sport. Both, you know, not only in Australia and the UK, but here in the US with the New York Post. For a time, he owned the Chicago Sun-Times and the Boston Herald as well. And, you know, that tabloid blood is coursing through the veins of Fox News, even if its political stripes are a little more conservative than even his own right-of-center views.
And those tabloids, in all those cases you just mentioned, and on to Fox News, got influence over the national governments in Australia, in the UK, here in the United States. Was that a conscious strategy of Murdoch's?
Yeah, look, he's genuinely a creature of the political right. He is a conservative guy, reflexively in many ways, although his views, as I mentioned, aren't really as conservative as some of the most popular figures on Fox News. But, you know, one of his sources of influence and genius politically in some sense is that he really is willing to throw the support of his newspapers to major figures of both major political parties in all three of these great English-speaking nations. So he'll toggle back between, you know, Democrats of the center-left, like Hillary Clinton running for Senate in 2000 and again in 2006 here in New York State, where, you know, the New York Post supported her, and then to people on the right, you know, Republicans can otherwise get support. Tony Blair, a figure of the center-left, he sort of cast aside some of the Labour Party in the UK's socialist traditions and history to form a more centrist company, and he left John Major and the Conservative Party, Murdoch did, and swung his four newspapers to the side of Blair. And when he thought that Blair's partner, rival, and successor, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, was spent, he then switched his papers over to support the Conservative Party of David Cameron, who's now the Prime Minister. And this accomplishes a couple things. I mean, among other things, it means that both parties kind of have to stay on their toes because both of them have hopes of winning his endorsements. You know, the New York Times is unlikely to endorse a Republican for office anytime soon. The Wall Street Journal is unlikely to endorse a Democrat for presidency anytime soon. And that's a Murdoch publication that's a bit more conservative on its editorial pages than Mr. Murdoch himself is. But the tabloid here, the New York Post, and his newspapers throughout the rest of his English-speaking empire really are willing to toggle back and forth, and that gives him so much more influence than if it was predictably one party or the other.
You mentioned the Wall Street Journal, and at some point he started taking the money that his corporation made from those tabloids and buying prestige papers, the Times of London, Wall Street Journal, and others. Why did he make that jump?
Well, he's always played sort of a two-level game when it came to newspapers. You know, he makes his money through the tabloids and shapes popular opinion and sort of sets the acceptable realm of discourse for the publication, for the public at large, through his tabloids, which have these big readerships. And then he reaches an elites and shapes, you know, discourse for them through by owning these prestigious papers. So in Australia in 1964, there was general interest newspaper for the country at large. In 64, he created what was called The Australian, which is sort of as though it's the Wall Street Journal if its news pages had more of its opinion interlaced into its coverage. In the UK, he picked up the Times of London and the Sunday Times. And you're right, the Times of London has never made him a dime. You know, The Australian is unprofitable. The Wall Street Journal is barely profitable, but the New York Post, you know, he first bought it in 1977, I believe it was, and he's never made a dime off the Post either. But these papers help him to reach a wide audience and also to reach an audience that is viewed by politicians as their voters. And so he shapes the elite opinion with things like the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, the Australian, and he reaches the public, which these bigger tabloids. But there's one more element. You know, in recent years, even his big circulation papers have seen their revenues really decline. And one of the great values of having this influence at the top levels of government in all three of these major countries is that these are the same guys who make the decisions that can affect Murdoch's highly regulated holdings in, you know, cable television and in broadcast TV as well, and satellite TV. And as a result, you have people who feel that they owe you favors, who are in position to do you great benefits. And until this year when he split the company in two, those broadcasting and entertainment and television revenues really subsidized the losses at places like the Times of London and the New York Post.
When Rupert Murdoch starts or takes over an existing media outlet, how much of a stamp does he personally put on it?
He puts a great deal. You know, he was once asked under oath in England, about what he believed. And he said, anyone who wants to know what I think, is welcome just to read the Sun tabloid every day. And in this country, it would pretty much hold true for the New York Post. It's anti-elitist, it's right of center, it's brawling, it likes to treat, it likes to cover sports, it likes to treat celebrities as sport, it likes to treat politicians as sport, you know, the inherent assumption that most of them are either philanderers or crooks or both. And it's his belief that behind closed doors, people are cheating the everyday people that he alone somehow has a connection to. When he bought the Wall Street Journal, though, you know, the first weeks and months, he was in the newsroom here in Midtown Manhattan, and he was looking at headlines. I guess actually initially it was downtown near the old financial center before they moved it up close to our offices here in Midtown Manhattan. But, you know, he would go through and he'd look at headlines and layouts, and suddenly you saw a lot more color photographs, incorporated into the front page and the section fronts. You saw bigger headlines and bolder language used and fewer really long pieces from the front page. And all of that is consistent with what his editors that he brought in, you know, advised, but it was also very consistent with the man himself. And, you know, when it comes to his tabloids, he really talked to those guys on an almost daily basis. You know, it was as though the sun never set on Murdoch's empire. I was told by the former editor and publisher of the New York Post that in the days before email and caller ID on phones, that you know every editor had two phones on his or her desk, and they were almost all men. The first phone would be the phone that your secretary would route all your calls to, and the second phone was like a bat phone that only Rupert, and if you were feeling very brave, maybe your spouse would also have the number to. And that, you know, he would call if it was morning in Sydney, Australia, he would call that phone. If it was morning in London, he'd call the Sun or the News of the World. If it was morning in New York or Chicago or Boston, he'd call those phones. And he was always, every hour available to him awake was an hour to call his tabloid editors and say, you know, Murdoch here, what do you have? What do you know?
We're talking to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about his new book on Rupert Murdoch's media empire. It's called Murdoch's World.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about Rupert Murdoch or thoughts about the impact he's had on media and politics? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation with a look at some of the scandals facing that media empire coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.